Community is where everybody works together today to ensure that everybody can eat tomorrow. This thought leads us to ask, can one farm community?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1349th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Paphos who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, a while ago I had a consulting contract on the island nation of Cyprus. The task was to find a crop with an economy sufficient to repopulate an agricultural plateau near the village of Acordalia that had been depopulated by the jobs available in coastal casinos. As I strolled the plateau with my hosts, we came upon a village of Greeks happily harvesting their grapes across the way. Though they were too far away to hear what was being said, we could easily hear their laughter and sense their joy at being engaged in the task at hand. It was a living picture straight out of the Bible. This, my host said, is what we want to bring back to Cyprus. Well, I recently heard that same laughter and sensed that same joy while strolling the grounds of Live Earth Farm in Watsonville, California, and have been endeavoring to capture its essence with a three-part Food Chain series on what I call contrary farming. By contrary, I simply mean in opposition to the convention of the day. The first show in the series, Farming Children, featured Jessica Ridgway and the Farm Discovery Program, which brings children, a lot of children, to the farm so they can reach down to the earth and harvest a living thing. The second show, Farming Nature, featured Joanne Baumgartner from Wild Farm Alliance and Sam Earnshaw from Hedgerows Unlimited, who, like modern-day Johnny Appleseeds, travel around the country to bring nature and her wildlife back to the farm. As you can see, both of these shows feature a contrariness to the industrial model of farming that makes one smile, and both also find a home in today's show, Farming Community, in which we will ask, how can one farm community? And who better to ask than the community's Farmer of the Year, Tom Brose of Live Earth Farm in Watsonville, California. Tom, welcome to the Food Chain.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, so how about we start our conversation off today by asking, why do you populate Live Earth Farm with laughter and joy?
It is the essence of inspiration. When you hear laughter on the farm, you know there is passion, there's joy, and there's, you know, just people who are working and enjoying the land, you know, are connected.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talked with Jessica Ridgway, and we talked with Joanne Baumgartner and Sam Earnshaw about how, yeah, they bring children and they bring nature back to Live Earth Farms. Do those elements play into the laughter and joy?
You know, when you bring people together, it doesn't matter if it's the workers that, you know, grow the crops, the farmers who grow the crops, the kids that come and enjoy the land, like you probably discovered through the Discovery Program with Jessica Ridgway. There's just something special. You know, there's always, you know, a connection, not just with each other, but also with what's, you know, just in front of them. And that's can be on the farm, can be so many things, you know, whether it's the surprises that nature has, whether it's the animals, the insects, you know, the flowers, just the beauty all around. And then it's, of course, also sometimes you work really hard and you even, you know, get some inspiration and laughter out of that. You know, the one thing when you mentioned laughter and the picture that I have in mind right now is when we pack our CSA shares, our community supported agriculture shares, every week for our community. There's music, there's chatter, there's laughter when we put what we harvested into the boxes that our members receive. And I think, now that you're mentioning it, we're not just packing food, but we're packing laughter right into those boxes. So I think that's kind of what comes to mind.
Well, good. So it seems like just about everything you do at Live Earth Farm runs contrary to the industrial model of farming. Do you consider yourself to be a proud contrarian?
That's a good question. A contrarian, I think I definitely believe that we have a model that is not what we would consider the conventional food system that's, dominant in this country, in the world. In that way, I would say, yes, I'm a contrarian. I do also respect, a lot of the, in our farming community, the people that are engaged in that model of, the more conventional models. I see a lot of, benefit of just understanding, how they go about their business and how they farm and how they have to survive. I feel that it's the larger community that we all belong to. And I think it's the cross-pollination that needs to happen in order to hopefully move the whole system into a direction that is more sustainable.
Very good. So you are a proud contrarian, even though you won't admit it, right?
We can probably discuss that term.
Okay. Fair enough. Well, I once hosted Gene Logsdon on the Food Chain Radio mm-hmm. Show, and he wrote a book called The Contrarian Farmer. But I couldn't get him to laugh about it in the least bit. So I'm glad you could laugh about it because it's really fun. So you are a community-supported agriculture farm, a CSA farm, which we've seen become quite popular throughout the land. So maybe you could walk us through what exactly a CSA farm is for those people who, for example, might get all of their food from the big box store. So what exactly is a CSA farm?
The term community-supported agriculture really was introduced to me when I was an apprentice at the University of Santa Cruz Agroecology Program way back in 1995. And it is still today what inspires me about community-supported agriculture, which is that you grow food where you're in relationship with the people who eat that food. And what's the supported part means is that the community, the people that receive the food, share in the risks and in all that goes into growing that food and participates in it, when I was a naive and probably still very idealistic kind of young wannabe farmer in those days, I thought that was a concept that I could embrace fully and what it really meant was that I that the community was sharing in what we at Live Earth Farm were doing, and that was growing the food making a commitment to the consumers that were receiving that food. So every time we planted something, we harvested something, we knew who was going to receive it, and in return we got a commitment, whether it was financial or whether it was also in the early days, a lot of people came and helped in the actual growing of the food. It was, just a shared kind of commitment between the grower, the farmer, and the people who ate the food. So that concept, I always feel, is still important today, is that we need to make sure that the community that receives our food understands that there's a risk sharing in the process of growing food.
Mm-hmm. Now, to bring this down to a practical sense, what your customers do essentially is pay it forward to you. Is that not true?
Correct. So, for example, in the spring when today we have a year-round CSA program, and in the earlier days where we basically had less of a system that was, digitized and automized, we had to communicate in different ways. We basically sent out letters to our community and said, look, we're going to be offering shares for a certain period of the season, 20, 25, 30, 40 weeks of the year. And we ask members to pay upfront, for the entire season or part of the season. And that helped us early on to be able to start the farm and also to, plan every season, the crop plan, purchasing the equipment and as well as all the inputs that we needed to get the farm going.
So that's pretty amazing when you think about it, because instead of having to go to a bank and borrowing ahead, you're going to your customers and they're paying ahead. And in a sense, as you say, assuming some of the risk for growing that crop. So you're really bringing your customers into your business as almost as partners, it seems.
That is true. And I think in the early days, I think this was more so than it is today. I think the CSA concept today has been, I would say, somewhat compromised with a lot of the demand and the competition and how the whole concept of farm to consumer marketing, how that has evolved. And there's just a lot more choices in how people can access food directly from farmers. And so today the concept is a little more consumer driven. It's still a commitment, that people make. But it's, I think over the years, that concept of risk sharing, I think, has been diluted. So we had to modify, of course, our operation to broaden the sense of community. And we, whether it was going to farmers market and connecting with the community that way, or whether we had relationships with, restaurants and stores, that all played into our, kind of business plan that we felt, we needed to diversify into.
Good. We'll pick that up here when we come back from the break, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, today we're asking a really interesting question. Can one farm community? And, well, we have the man here who can help us answer that question. He is the Farmer of the Year, Tom Brose, of Live Earth Farm in Watsonville, California. We will be right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
A community-supported agriculture program, and really in which those who eat the food get to participate it to one extent or another with the farmer in the growing and processing and selling and eating of that food. So it's a way of bringing the community to the farm and to the food from the farm. Well, we're with Tom Brose, our community's Farmer of the Year of Live Earth Farm in Watsonville, California. And Tom, we've got a CSA farm. How many members or customers did you start with when you started your CSA farm?
The very first season, we started with 25 members. So we started on an acre of land that we started, digging by hand. We made handmade beds, and everything was very manual. in those days. But it was a good way to start and really understand kind of what we were getting ourselves into. And it grew very quickly from those 25 members in 1995 to today, almost 950 members, you know, give or take.
From 25 to 950.
Yeah, it's been a journey, and you know, there's a lot that can be said about, you know, expanding that concept, that community supported agriculture concept. But one thing that never really wavered is to stay local and to connect with you know, the consumers and the members of our CSA. Within a radius of, you know, no more than 100 miles around the farm.
In your area, there are farmers who have taken the notion of organic food national, and they have become very big in the process of doing that. You resisted that direction. Why? Why did you stay local?
Well, I felt there was really... two models. One is to, you know, grow something for people directly in your community and just focus on diversity, on quality, on, and really, you know, being able to keep the farm at an operation that doesn't always feel the pressure, that doesn't always feel the pressure of having to grow, you know, and that there's something to be said about not having to grow all the time. And that is, it has to do with, you know, having to put more capital always into your system. It's always this pressure of having to you know, I mean, like everything in our economy, I think, is always pointing to growth. And you're being judged how fast you grow and how much you make, and that was just not something that I wanted to embrace, and that's not the kind of farming that I wanted to pursue. So I looked into ways to diversify more into how much we can, you know, do things, bring the community onto the farm, and that's where the education program, for example, came in, and where we could provide other services.
In spite of not wanting to have the pressure to grow you did, from 25 members to 950 members, but you, I assume that you did that kind of organically with respect to, you let it grow on its own accord and didn't try to force it by bringing in money from outside.
Well, money always had, I mean, money is something that we all need to work with. I mean, there's no other way to grow a farm, even at our scale. You know, we have about 60 acres in cultivation, which in here in California is considered a small farm. And what we really focused on is, one, to keep our workers employed year round, and that was a really important piece and having a workforce that really is part of the community. And today, you know, we have still the same workforce. Many of the ones that started with us 25 years ago are still with us today, and even the children of the workers, you know, that have grown up here on the farm are now are part of what we do. So over the years, as you say, we grew organically, but not without having to look at, you know, improving what we're doing, from the equipment to the infrastructure that's necessary to be able to sustain ourselves.
Well, good.
So yes, we did need capital, you know, to be able to, you know, purchase the things that are needed in an operation like ours, whether it's the tractors, whether it's, you know, packing shed, and, you know, all those pieces are, you know, really, really important. And the land itself is really expensive here. So There's no way around that.
Well, there you go. Let's go back a little bit, take a step back and ask you how you go about building a community-supported agriculture farm. You know, there is a recipe for rabbit stew that begins with the admonition, first, catch the rabbit, which is good advice, right? No rabbit, no rabbit stew. So where did you start? What was your rabbit?
The rabbit is, what is my rabbit? That is, for us, I mean, for me, it's always the land. The land is where it all starts. And then building the relationship with the land to grow food and to sustain, the business as well as the vision that one has. And over the years, to steward the land in such a way that we can have a sustainable system, that's always been the goal, we started really with 5 acres and then 20 acres, and we started looking at land, as we grew and there's more and more demand for what we were doing. There were more members who wanted to join our community supported agriculture program. It was kind of a natural progression, and we were able to access land just here in and around Watsonville to be able to grow with the demand of what the community wanted us, to do. I think it was in the early years, we had a waiting list and not till we kind of felt like we were at capacity did we really kind of slow down. So the early years were definitely a growth period where we went from, that one first acre, we grew quickly to 30 and 35 acres. And we started leasing land, that was a big step. That was something where once you start hiring people and you start really expanding your business, the whole process starts becoming more complicated and the risks are much, much larger. And that's where I think, again, having that certainty that we had a community of consumers, I would almost say eaters, people eat food and they're not just consuming food, that really were the backbone of every decision we made. And so as we went along, we always had feedback. We had community meetings just to understand kind of where the farm, in what direction the farm needed to go. And
So in set, it sounds like you were led by your customers.
Your customers, very much so,
yeah. Your customers told you what to do, which is always the essence of good marketing, I think. What significance does environment play in Live Earth Farms?
Well, we have an amazing, we're fortunate to be able to grow almost year round, and the climate here in the Pajaro Valley is incredible. We have probably one of the best growing conditions anywhere in the world, from the soil to the climate. And we're very fortunate to be able to farm here. We're just far enough away from the coast where we get enough heat to be able to grow, the warm weather, the summer crops, as well as the cool the crops that, will also grow in the winter. We can grow in the summer, whether it's broccoli, all the cooler loving crops. Those are the ones that, we grow almost 40 different kinds of crops throughout the season. And that gives us the ability to really sustain a rotation that is that works, you know, for the consumers as well as for the land.
Well, I think of Joanne and Sam bringing nature and nature's wildlife to your farm. And I wonder what impact that has on your customers. Is that something important for your customers to know that there's nature on the farm?
Yeah. You know, important aspect, Michael, is that every week when we send out a share of the harvested crops to our members, there's always a component that explains what's in that box. What did it take? You know, members are very connected through newsletters, of course, now through social media. And, you know, we constantly communicate with our members. You know, the phone is always available to people to call, just call us and find out, you know, why something may be looking a little different in a box. Or there's a lot of education that goes into, you know, what it takes to bring that food to somebody's, you know, kitchen. Mm-hmm. And so that I think is a big part of what we do. So that connection with nature is a part of that. This is to understand that when we grow food and surrounded by a natural landscape and actually encouraging, nature in and around the cultivated areas of the farm, that part is needs to be explained, because it's hard to really grasp when you're just picking up a box, you know, on a weekly basis. And what qualities are we bringing to the foods that you're eating? And that is protecting the landscape from erosion, you know, encouraging a lot of the wildlife that exists in the natural landscapes around here, I think is really important. And then also understanding the benefits that we get from having these more natural areas around our fields, from, you know, having the beneficials really balance out some of the, you know, the pest insects. And I don't even want to call them pests, because they're just there because, you know, there is something that's unbalanced. And so it's always this process of trying to balance things out between what we're growing and what really is the natural kind of landscape around it.
Mm-hmm. And communicating that environment to your customers is a great way of adding value, because it's not just food that you're bringing to people, it's environment, it's nature.
Correct.
And who knows what's in that tomato that you get from the big box store. The other thing that seems to be of significance to you is soil. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody wants to be green these days. And I pride myself in being a brownie, in that I think it all starts in the soil, which is brown, and you don't get to the green before you go to the brown. But that's just my way of thinking. What do you think?
Well, soil is not just brown; it's alive. You know, soil is like a living organism. You know, we don't look at it that way. We always, you know, kind of decry, or we always say soil is dirt, you know, and sometimes we, you know, think of dirt as something that we shouldn't be, you know, touching or being, you know, having on our bodies. And soil is really what allows us to, you know, to be healthy and to be alive, you know, and to bring that understanding to not just the consumer, but also just bring that greater understanding of how soil is really the foundation of everything we do takes time, you know, and sometimes making the decisions to favor the life in the soil is where it's at, you know, and to not compromise. And I think that's really difficult in farming. You know, we always have this pressure of trying to, you know, come out on top financially, which is important.
Spend less and get more, right? But if
we always think, well, can we extract just a little more out of that resource? And I think that's really where that balancing act is, and that's where the community again is so important, because a community that can understand that and continues to purchase your products based on that decision making, and to really understand that, that's where it's at. I think that's where the crux of the relationship really is at.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, with Tom Brose and you. We're talking about building a community-supported agriculture farm. Right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
So much to a farm that grows community. There's all kinds of people. There's the environment. There's soil. What about labor, Tom Brose? You said that you're able to keep laborers for 25 years. Must be something on that farm that keeps people other than just wages.
Oh, yeah. The backbone of any farm is, you know, the people who, it's the community of workers, you know, and we really are like a family here on this farm. I have to say that sounds a little corny, but when we really, you know, care for each other, and we know. And that's also something that I think, at least on our farm, I think I'm really proud of, is to see how the people really care when they when the tractor driver that you know is, it goes to the, you know, Scotts Valley Farmers Market on weekends and sells the produce that he's been growing and caring for. And can actually look a consumer in the eye and say, you know, this is something that I grew, you know. And I think there's a lot of pride in being able to, you know, sell and bring to the customer something that you put your, you know, life into. So it's the backbone of the farm, you know, just like I talked about the soil. The workers that really care for that soil are really key, and because it's the little decisions and the decisions how we interact with everything we do is so important. You know, whether it's how you cut that broccoli, when do you sow your cover crops? You know, the timing, the care that goes into all the details of growing from seed to harvest is a specialization. It's, you know, we always say farm workers, you know, are not skilled laborers. And that's something that is just so wrong. You know, people that work and farm and grow food, I think they're extremely skilled. We should really honor that. And, you know, we really felt that during the pandemic, you know, we suddenly realized how important the people that grow our food are.
Amen to that. And speaking of all the details, I think of the crops. You said you had, what, 40 crops, 40 different crops?
Yeah, it's 40, sometimes even 50. It really depends on the crop plan, you know, that we put together. And it has to do also with, you know, kind of the what our customers demand, you know, whether it's at the farmers market or the restaurants or the CSA members. So it varies, but just around 40 to 50 crops.
Well, it's 40 and 50 crops, but some of those crops are planted multiple times a year, some in succession with other crops. So the details must be simply incredible. You must need artificial intelligence to keep track of all the details, but you don't. You're people, and your people have that knowledge. So that's really something. So crops, which crop did you start with? What was crop number one?
You know, I think every farmer has their favorite crop. And I grew up in the highlands of the Andes in the country in Ecuador. And the one crop that from little on, I was always in awe with and I loved is potatoes. So potatoes is something that probably inspired me to get involved in farming. And so that was the first crop when I started Live Earth Farm our family started Live Earth Farm. I still have a picture of planting that first potato crop. I love a lot of other crops, of course, whether it's strawberries or apples. Some you learn to love and others you just love because that's what you grew up with or your mother. My mother had a big garden and, you know, there was, of course, the summer crops like, you know, the tomatoes and the carrots. I love root crops just because there's something magical about, you know, being able to pull something out of the ground that you can eat. And potatoes definitely are like these treasures that, you know, just kind of appear when you're.
When did you bring your customers into the decision-making process about which crops to plant?
Oh, early on. First, as soon as we started farming, maybe not that very first year because we just didn't have yet the consumers or the customers. But second year for sure, we always had like community meetings where we come together and say, well, what is it that we wanted to grow and what can we grow? And so, yeah, we had early on, we had CSA community meetings every year to kind of hash out the crop plan. That has changed somewhat now. You know, we have a pretty good understanding, but we still send out surveys and, you know, ask people what they would like to see us grow and, you know, and we integrate that as best as we can.
Can you recall any specific crop that your customers brought to you and say, please grow this?
Yes. I have to say there's one crop that I had no idea even existed, and it was shiso. Shiso is an herb that is used in sushi and I think is popular in Japan. And one of our customers who had lived in Japan, he wanted to see if we could grow that. And it was a very unusual request and we grew it. And lo and behold, it was something that, you know, grew well here. But I think a lot of members will have, you know, especially their favorite crops, of course, there's certain varieties, like in the pepper, you know, certain kinds of peppers. We have people from Eastern Europe, you know, who would like to have the Hungarian style peppers, you know, that are very different from the bell peppers. And we have some, you know, very special requests from, you know, more around the hot peppers, you know, that are becoming increasingly popular. And then apples, you know, we started growing apples and people have certain, you know, varieties in mind that they grew up with, like the Macintosh, a variety that we grew because certain members really, really liked them. So we grafted trees over to, you know, growing Macintosh apples. So, yeah, it's like every year we try to kind of reassess, you know, what is something that consumers will like to see us grow.
Do you see a lot of trends in eating wherein, you know, it might be Red Delicious one year and a Macintosh the next?
The Wet Delicious is probably not a good example.
That's a bad example, right?
But I would say, you know, there are trends, and it's around certain culinary trends. You know, sometimes it's more has to do with, for example, the Asian cuisine has really, you know, taken off, and so some people really like to see more us grow more. You know, bok choy, or you know, Napa cabbage, or people started looking into fermenting, you know, foods, and so pickles, and you know, certain kind of cucumbers, you know, to pickle, and Napa cabbage, you know, for kimchi and things. So we do see that there's trends, but there is the, you know, we always have our go-to crops, you know, whether it's the tomato, or whether it's, you know, some having really good greens, you know, the greens and the broccolis, those are just always kind of the staples. And then around those staples, we have, you know, we grow the things that certain people really want to have.
Sure.
Like, you know, for a certain period of time, we had Padron peppers, you know, and that was a trend for a few years, and that kind of sloughed off.
Then, with so many different crops, 40, 50 crops, how do you go about organizing your harvest and distribution?
That's always every day is a day where we just plan our harvest. Like right now, you know, it's middle of the season, and it, really things are really, I mean, it's probably the most intense time of the year for the next 3 months. And first we have the CSA membership that orders, you know, what they would like to see in their shares every week. We went from, you know, we customize our shares nowadays. So, on Monday we will have, you know, the whole list of crops that we, you know, posted on the website that will be available the following week. And so members will order what they want, and we will, you know, harvest accordingly and pack that. And then we have the farmers markets, you know, they're kind of separate, but kind of similar in kind of what each market has their own kind of demand. And the way we go about it is that we have a team of, that harvests, you know, daily. And since we're about 35 employees, and some focus more on strawberries, maybe some focus more on the greens, and we just kind of create a schedule depending on where the demand is. You know? So every week and every day we really have a harvest schedule. And sometimes it's, you know, around meeting a certain customer's demand. Let's say if it's a store, that is a very different way of harvesting than if it's for the CSA or if it's for a restaurant. You know, so we have to adjust a little bit, you know, each of the harvests.
You know, it sounds to me like you're always doing something different every day. And therefore, mm-hmm. How is it possible to get bored?
Yeah, boredom is that word that never really comes up.
Good. Well, let me ask you this then. How can those of us out here in the world become very good CSA members? What does it take to be a good CSA member, a good customer?
I think anyone who is interested in eating with the seasons and locally, I think that's a really important step. And with that, you immediately start looking at kind of what we call the local food shed, you know, and as soon as you start looking at what's growing in, you know, where you live seasonally and locally, you start connecting with, you know, farms like ours. You know, there's there's a lot of farmers that are kind of in line with the same growing philosophy as we do. And farmers markets are a great way to start, seeing what's available locally and then, making that connection with the farmers at the farmers markets is really important. And of course, today you can really search for farms in and around where you live and start asking the questions. I think it's really important that anyone can just visit. Our farm is the one thing that I always say is every customer should have access to the farm, and if they have the time to see what we do, should always be welcomed. So it's important to just educate yourself a little bit, and then ask questions. And there's no wrong question about around food.
Well, Tom Bros, a few years ago, not that long ago, a couple decades, you were a rare creature indeed, there's so few of you. Today, I think I counted 181 certified farmers markets in the San Francisco Bay region. So you really are a trend in yourself when it gets right down to it, and changing the way we all eat out here. Has it been an exciting ride for you?
It's been amazing. I mean, I look back and I said, would I have ever, done something different? I'm just fortunate that I've been able to, stick with it and be able to farm in this way. It's not been easy. I can't say it's this is something that just drops in your hands, and there's a lot of things that we just don't know, the risks that we take and how they will turn out. I think we have a real at this point in time, I think a real important job to do, and that is to, create more consciousness around our food systems and how we eat. And I think
And
our little
with you,
farm.
and with that, Tom, we just ran out of time, but you're most eloquent in your contrariness in farming. Thank you so much. Tom Bros, Farmer of the Year, Live Earth Farm, Watsonville, California.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends miss the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.